My name is Mary and I am an alcoholic. I'm so grateful to be here and grateful to be sober. My dry date is the 10th of August 1984. My group is the Shepherd Group in Toronto. On a Tuesday night we have an open meeting, on a Thursday night we have a big book study. My sponsor is Norma L. and Mississauga, and I am an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am so delighted to be here with you. This has been an absolutely marvelous convention. You sure know how to do it right in Georgia. I would like to thank the wonderful women who kept in contact with me, Deborah, Lisa, Kathy. I'd like to thank Rebecca, Lynn, and the committee, and whoever it was that made up that beautiful basket. Thank you so much. And Amy. Amy is the hostess with the mostess. I mean, she said I say that to all the girls, but I don't. And she's been absolutely marvelous, and there is nothing that has been too much trouble. And we have been chatting and truly enjoying our time together. Thank you so much. And I'd like to thank Lee and John and Dave, the wonderful tapers who come and do all of this stuff for us and do what they do to make things. I remember in the early days I used to live listening to CDs. And it's a great service they perform. And also the people in the hospitality suite, I've been in there, so thank you. When I was coming across the border, you know, we have to clear U.S. customs in Toronto. And they're always asking me odd questions because they'll say to me, why are you going to the U.S.? And I will say, I'm going to speak at a conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes they'll say, why? Why you? You know. And I want to say to them, well, do you have an hour? An hour. oh, by the way, don't let me forget the wonderful trustees and delegate and all you wonderful people that give service to keep Alcoholics Anonymous running. Thank you so much. Yeah. Anyway, this time he said to me, are you a member? I said, yes, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a recovering alcoholic. He said, how long have you been sober? And I said, 27 years. He said, that's longer than me and a lot of these guys have been alive. And I thought about that, and I thought, God, how time passes. And you know, I wanted to say to him, because it came into my head, at 27 years of age, I was 2 years into my alcohol and 27 years into my ism. You see, it is my opinion that I was born with the illness of alcoholism. It is my opinion that I was born with something deep inside of me that just didn't feel as if I belonged anywhere. And that the only solution for me would be a drink of alcohol. But I did not know that. I am so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. It has lifted me from the place that is the darkest place, from a place where everything of value in my life was taken from me, from a place from which most of us never come back. And I am back, and I am here, and there is no bridge from where I'm coming from. Because of the wonderful, wonderful dedicated lives of Bill and Dr. Bob and Anne and Lois and all the early members, you know, I often think to myself, Alcoholics Anonymous could never have started anywhere else but in the United States of America. It is because of the freedom to have a God of your own understanding, that great message that came from Carl Jung, why we have Alcoholics Anonymous. It is an amazing thing, and I'm so grateful. As you can hear, I'm from Canada. I got sober in Canada, but I am not Canadian. I was born in Glasgow, Scotland. My parents were Irish. I used to think I was an Irish Scot until I went on Ancestry.com and discovered I had some English blood, which I threw out of balance for a little while. And then I thought about it, you know, being Irish born in Scotland was a great dilemma to me, because being Irish born in Scotland, half of me wanted to drink all the time and the other half didn't want to pay for it. And then when I found out about this English part, I thought, oh, that was the Al-Anon trying to get us all together in there, yeah. It says in a big book that it didn't do to know that we were outright mental defectives or in full flight from reality. And I absolutely knew, without a shadow of a doubt, that that applied to me. You see, I always knew there was something wrong with me, and the reason I knew there was something wrong with me is because people were always saying to me, there's something seriously wrong with you. You know, and as I've said before, my mother used to take me to Ireland every year because we had relations there. And we'd go to Ireland and we'd sit down there and the neighbours would come to welcome my mother. And they would sit and they would stare at my mother and they'd look at me and they'd stare at my mother and they'd look at me and they'd say to my mother, she's not right, you know. And if you're not right in Ireland, you're not right anywhere. So I knew I was done. It is an odd thing to be born feeling as if you don't belong anywhere. If you were to ask me how I felt, I would say to you that all my life I felt different. All my life I felt less than, and all my life I felt as if I was on the outside looking in. I felt as if everybody knew the answer to a question and I didn't even know how to phrase the question. And what that did for me was it made me feel angry, and it made me feel upset, and it made me act out in a way that I should never have acted out. I came from a wonderful family. They were good Roman Catholic people, hard-working people. My mother was a lady. She never went out without her hat and her gloves. And I was just different. And from a very early age, I don't know what happened to me, but I decided to be a rebel. And I was angry at everybody in the world. And I behaved in a way that I am so... When I think about that person today, I think about her as her. I think about her as her because I just cannot coincide that person to the person that's standing here today. Because I truly believe that what we get here through the 12 steps is a transformative experience, and thank God for that. But you know, Dr. Silva said that in the early days before the foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous, they realized that alcoholics needed some kind of a moral psychology. And I certainly needed moral psychology because I was not moral. And nobody taught me to be that way. I was lying, cheating, and stealing from a very early age, and my mother was ashamed of me. And you know, unfortunately, I had something that a lot of alcoholics have, although you will never hear any Al-Anon give us any credit, and that is I had a high IQ. And the way a high IQ works for me is that I push on doors marked pool. I never read directions. It takes me 3 hours to open a box that my granddaughter will say, oh, you just push that, and it goes up. You know. It's a high IQ doesn't guarantee you anything except that you'll never complete anything you ever start. And I was in a very complex place, and I was sent to a convent to be educated by nuns, and they tried to teach me about God. They tried to teach me about having character. They were Franciscan nuns. And I don't know if you know the Franciscan nuns, but they have big sleeves. And they keep weapons inside these sleeves. And when I was 15, I was not a fun girl, and I was acting out, and one of the nuns hit me over the knuckles with the ruler. She had it down to a fine art. It was lightning fast. You couldn't see it coming. You just felt it. And I wasn't feeling particularly loving that day, and I figured if she gave it, she could take it. And consequently, I was expelled. But what I will share with you here is that I learned something from that experience. I learned shame, which was to be my companion for a long time. I learned that if I wanted to go on in the world, I would have to learn to take instruction. I learned that if I wanted to get on in the world, I would have to honor authority, things that were anathema to me. I always had a vision of myself. I don't know if you've ever seen Braveheart. When he's lying on the rack shouting, freedom. That was how I saw myself. And I realized I was going to have to conform at some level, and I did not want to do that. But you know, the Mother Superior told me to sit outside her room, and she said if I memorize something on the wall, it might do something for my measly little life. And I looked at this thing on the wall, and it said, of courtesy it is much less than courage of heart or holiness, but in my walks to me it seems that the grace of God is in courtesy. And way back then I wanted nothing to do with the grace of God and nothing to do with courtesy. But many years later, coming through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was the grace of God that brought me here. And it was the great courtesy that you accorded me that made me begin to feel like a human being and a woman one more time. So it came true. Eventually I went into nursing, I got bored with nursing, and this is the illness of alcoholism. I was restless, irritable and discontent. I did not want to drink. I did not know that a drink was my solution. I was born on high alert. Consequently, everybody around my house were like Ellen describes. They were all shaking every time I went round. My mother used to pretend to read a newspaper and she'd be staring at me out of the side of it like this. And I used to say to her, what are you looking at? She'd say, I don't know where you came from. And if she didn't know, who knew? Also, with all my family, I used to say, I'm going out for the evening. They'd say, see if you can get yourself adopted and make sure it's a Catholic. I did not bring them security, I guess. They found me odd, and so did the rest of the world. And I became a bit of an introvert then, an angry introvert. And eventually I went down to London, England, and I joined British Airways when I was 21. It was then called BOAC. And I had on the British Airways uniform, and I was looking good, but I was dropping apart. You see, when I was 13, I started having panic attacks. And the reason I had these panic attacks was that I was encased in self. I was absolutely encased in self. I used to have visions of a self that would go on forever and ever and ever, into an eternity as a mindless being, and I would have panic attacks. And I used to imagine if what it would be like if only I could get out of myself one time. If only I could get out of myself and walk away and see me standing there and me having left self. And I didn't understand it. And I guess it was all tied in with this IQ I had and this lack of education and this utter and complete absorption of self. So I thought if I get one of these jobs, then I will begin to look like all these other people that have on a uniform. And I loved that job, and I had on the British Airways uniform, and I had a sense of identity, and I had a wonderful job because of the nursing. I was able to fly out to Africa and Asia and pick up patients and bring them back. And I'd go out as a passenger or come back as a passenger. It was a wonderful job. The only thing is I don't like people. And I am encased in an aircraft and I have panic attacks. So it was not fun. And I thought to myself, as I was to say many times, self. Self. Because there was no one else to talk to, you see. And men thought I was cute, but crazy. So I would say, self, why don't you get married? If you get married, you'll be well. So I went off looking for someone to marry. And I found a really nice man. I married a nice, cultured, refined, wealthy man. And he married a figment of my imagination. and we went to live in Kingston, Jamaica. And in Jamaica, I had everything that money could buy. I had my BMW. My husband had 5 homes on the island. And I had everything. And after a year, my first son was born. Now, I had everything in the world that should have made me happy. There was wealth, there was love, and there was this beautiful little boy that when I held him in my arms, I thought, look at this miracle. I love this child with every fiber of my being. I've never felt any love like that for anything in my life. And just after he was born, I thought I was going insane. Finally, and irrevocably, insane. And someone said, have a drink. And Jamaica has 151 proof rum. It is beautiful. I drank that 151 proof rum and it went all the way deep down inside of me like a piece of velvet, and it wrapped itself around every piece of raw nerving I had had for 25 years. For 25 years I had been walking the world, never knowing where I belonged, feeling like an alien, never seeing a country that I could belong in or another person I felt like, feeling so less than, feeling so inferior, feeling as if I was quite mad. And I have this drink, and then I have another drink, and then I have another drink. And for the first time in my life, my skin fit. That's all. But it's magic. Dr. Silkworth said men and women drink because they like the sense of ease and comfort that they get. For some of them, it's the only normal living. And I certainly had that. And I immediately drank on a daily basis. And I drank copious amounts of alcohol. And it went on like that for 4 years until my second son was born. And because of the 12 steps and a loving God of my own understanding, I'm able to say to you today that I drank every day I was carrying that child. But he did not have fetal alcohol syndrome, and I'm so grateful. I did not want to drink, but I had lost the power of choice and drink very quickly. I had no choice. And then the cucumber became a pickle. And I started acting out. And I behaved very badly. And my husband used to take me to the country club where people used to welcome me and be so happy to see me. Now when they see me, they're not happy to see me. Because I can have one drink, two drinks, I'll be okay. Or I can have one drink, two drinks, and I will behave like a moron. Now, I have always had amazing ability to make benign, well-adjusted people behave like morons. That was before a drink. After a drink, it's doubled. And what happened, I would be obnoxious. Someone would say something I didn't like. I'd pick up a bottle and break it and challenge them to a duel. And you don't behave like that in the country club in Jamaica. My husband, again, like Ellen said today, my husband had developed a tic that I guess every man I've married to seems to have, this odd thing. And they have kind of jerky movements, like they're always getting ready to run. And my husband was such a gentleman, and what happened is he'd take me to the country club and he'd dance with someone else, and I would go up on the dance floor because, you know, when I drink I get psychotic and I get jealous, and if he'd be drinking with someone I would say something that wasn't awfully nice, and he'd run me off the floor in embarrassment and take me home and lecture me. And I would say to him, if you drop asleep tonight, I'll kill you. So he would go. A Inevitably, I would pass out and he'd run and lock himself in the bedroom. One night he didn't, and I hit him over the head with a piece of mahogany. And he had no sense of humor. None. So then the family came to me and they said to me, "We don't know what's wrong with you. We are an old established family in Jamaica. It's a small island. It's a small community. Everybody's talking about you and your behavior. We don't know what's wrong with you." My husband had called my mother and said, "There's something seriously wrong with your daughter." My mother said, "There was always something wrong with you." I mean, I don't know who my family are to talk. You know, I have an auntie. I think it runs in my family. I have an aunt, and, you know, if you sit and watch her, she, all of a sudden, she'll be drinking a cup of tea and she'll freeze in time. And the neighbors will come in and said, "What happened to her?" And my family say, "She's just away. She'll soon be back." I won't get into the other one, the iron board. It's too... no. So anyway, and so my in-law spoke to me, and rightly so. I'm so ashamed, you know. But I mean, that is now with consciousness. I don't know where I was back then. I was very sick, and I was very alcoholic. And as I say, nobody knew how much I drank. And so this my in-law said to me, "You know, you're supposed to be a Catholic, but you don't believe in God." You said, "You don't go to church. You know, you've been reported to the police for trying to beat up the dry cleaner, you know. And, you know, you got to find something. There's something wrong with you." And I had a wonderful helper called Gloria. And Gloria was marvelous to me. She was like a sister. And she was a very religious person. So Gloria took me to a downtown Kingston Jumping for Jesus charismatic meeting. And I was the only white person there. But I was jumping higher than everybody else. And because I had in rum. And I like to think I left them with some new moves, you know. I guess the best way to define me, apart from being completely insane, Bob Marley used to live across the road from me in Kingston. I lived on Hope Road, and his record producer had given him this old, beautiful old great house, and that's where Bob and his Rastafarians lived. And I was not happy about it because I thought Bob was a pothead. And I mean, it's funny, he didn't like me because I was an alcoholic. And, you know, Rastafarians do not like alcohol. And, you know, with Bob, I just didn't approve. And but everybody told me what a wonderful humanitarian he was. And he was. I mean, I used to look in, I could see right into his garden. And when he was in town, he'd be feeding all these poor people and giving them money and looking after them. And the Prime Minister's residence was just two doors up. And they went to Bob. He really cared about the poor people. Anyway, Bob and I, we had a couple of friends in common. But as I say, he did not like me and I did not like him. And I didn't know much about marijuana, to be honest. My gardener was the happiest person I've ever seen. You know, I mean, I didn't understand Django because his name is Django, and he used to smile, and anything I asked him he'd do it, and he'd be smiling and just moving around. And I saw all these plants in the back of my garden, way at the back, and I thought, they never seem to do much, these plants, and they have a funny smell. And I said, "What are those?" He said, "It's Jamaican spinach, Mum." Of course, it was Sensimilia. And in fact, some of my friends used to say to me, Mary, come try a little Sensimilia, man. Look how the liquor's making your eyes red. I say, I don't want nothing that's going to screw up my brain. I'll stick to liquor. Thank you. And, you know, I used to watch them, and I would watch them, what they were doing, you know, and they used to take a big spliff, and it was so big you couldn't even see their face. And they used to go, I just want to mellow out, man. Have a little vision. And they'd lie down and meditate. That's not me. When I drink, I want justice. When I drink, I want love. I will eventually end up lying down whether I want to or not. But not right now. Anyway, I saw Bob in the garage one day, and he had a BMW and I had a BMW. And I was standing there and I was kind of shaking in the breeze, half in the bag with my cigarette holder. And he said, hey, you. I said, yeah. He said, you're a narcissist and a hedonist, and you don't care about anything but yourself. I didn't have a reply to that, and because my brain was not functioning, and then he posed me a great question, and he said to me, what does BMW stand for, since you're so smart? I said, it means Bavarian Motor Works. He says, no man, it means Bob Marley and the Wailers. But he had me gone. He had me right. I was a hedonist and a narcissist. So what happened then is eventually I decided I was going to leave the island because the island was getting too small. And I was a hopeless alcoholic, and I knew that. And I don't know where my husband was at that time. I'd wake up with a glass of rum in my chest, and he'd be lying looking at me. He'd say, I think you were drinking a bit much last night, but that was about it. I'd gone down to 106 pounds, maybe even less. And I wanted to take my sons off the island. You see, that is a great conundrum to me, and that is what baffles me to this moment. And that is why I tell you this illness of alcoholism, where we laugh so much, it is a destroyer of lives. It is a horrendous illness. It is an illness to which no, there is no explanation by the medical profession. We cannot explain it. I don't understand it today. I don't understand this illness of alcoholism. I don't know what it's all about. I only know that it takes everything that I love. It takes all the innocence and the broken promises and broken dreams of children and all the things that I ever cared about and loved. It takes them all and it just throws them away like trash. And I am left wondering what has happened to my life because of this innocuous fluid that I've drank. I don't understand. So I am there with these things. I love my boys, and I love them, and they're 9 and 5, and I decide I'm going to leave the island, and my husband doesn't want me to take the children off the island. I divorce my husband, and I said, if you don't let me take them, I'm going to publish something in the paper I know about you, and that was the kind of person I was. And those children should never have been allowed to leave the island with me. But nobody could stop me. I needed to be committed, and there was no one to commit me, because no one really knew what was wrong with me. And I went to Scotland, and they told me about my drinking, and then a man said something to me, to which I've said yes to more times than I should have. And he said, let's get married, and I'll take you to Canada. And I thought, what a great idea, drink Canada dry, here I come. And He was a nice man. He was a born-again man. He was a born-again Christian, and he thought he could help me. But there must have been something wrong with him, or he wouldn't have married me, because, you know. And we went to Alberta, Canada, and within 6 months I had sent him away, because that's the kind of woman I am. That's the kind of person I was. I cared about nothing but myself. And I used people, and I was a user. And I'm so sorry about that today. And I didn't mean to be like that. And that is what alcohol did for me. It changed my personality. It made me into a creature that today I wouldn't even want to spend the same time in a room with. That's what it did for me. It gave me a change of personality. Appendix 2 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous say that if we work the 12 steps, we get a change of personality. Well, I got a change of personality when I drank, and I became a monster that cared for nothing but myself. And that was just my two little boys and me, and I have a job as a pharmaceutical rep, and I'm a blackout drinker on the road, and my territory was southern Alberta, Saskatchewan, and BC. And I don't know why I never killed anybody, because I'd be in blackouts driving, and didn't mean to do that either. And eventually I lost that job, and I ended up in detox in Calgary. And in detox in Calgary, it was just me and five Native Canadians. And they held my soup to me and my coffee to me when I was shaking too much to hold it by myself. And they told me that they drank because their spirit was broken. And I realized at some level my spirit was broken too. And that is why Carl Jung here, when I read the letter he wrote to Bill Wilson, where he said that the formula, he said, what the alcoholic has on a low level is a thirst for a union with God. He said he drinks spirit, but it's the wrong spirit. He said the formula for the alcoholic is spiritus contra spiritum. Spirit against spirit. The only thing that will help me and recover me from a hopeless condition of mind and body as an alcoholic is a spiritual program through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and a God of my understanding. That's the only thing that will heal the sick spirit. They cannot stop drinking spirit. It's a wonderful thing. And I got out of there and I went back to Jamaica because my boys needed their father. I'd been 2 years outside the island. I wasn't getting any child support because he was hoping that I would fail and he'd get me back to the island. And he did. The night before I was going back to Jamaica, I don't know if you get these wonderful ideas when you're drinking. I thought, you know, I want to go back really looking good. I did not look good anymore. I was 150-odd pounds, swollen with alcohol. And I thought, if I give myself a perm and dye my hair black, all in 2 hours, and I passed out. And the next day I was not looking good. And we landed in Jamaica and the children's father asked if they could have them for a week and they were gone for 13 years. And I decided I didn't know how to live without my boys. And you see what I did, because I'm selfish, self-centered, self-will run riot. I love my boys, but I'm not thinking of all the times in Canada when I was the only adult they had there. When they'd wake up and say, Mommy, who was that man you had last night? And I'd say, you were dreaming. When my alcohol made me question, my children question their reality. And drive with them drunk and hear them screaming. When they come home from school and see me lying drunk. And wake up in the morning and see me lying drunk. And I'm the only adult they have in Canada. Those poor little boys, those poor little boys that I never physically abused, but I am an alcoholic mother. And they did not deserve to have an alcoholic mother. And what had happened is my son, my eldest boy, who was 11, had written to his father and said that he didn't want to live with me anymore because he told him about my alcohol, my drinking. But I went and got two police jeeps and with my custody order. And they came with the machine guns. And we went up to this big old great house where my ex-husband lived with his new wife. and my sons were locked behind a big casing. And I said to my sons, bring the key. Your daddy's trying to keep you. And my eldest son said, I'm not coming anymore, Mommy. I don't want to live with you. And then the gardener came and threw me down the stairs. And the police pulled out the guns. And I said, let's go. And I went back to this old run-down house I had rented in Kingston. And took two bottles of rum and two bottles of 151 proof rum. And somebody phoned me, they pumped out my stomach, and the next day a psychiatrist came to me at the hospital in Kingston and told me something that was very observant, intellectually correct, and definitely relevant to my condition. He told me, you mustn't do that anymore. I eventually left the island and I went to live in Miami, and I didn't know anyone in Miami. I went to Miami to drink myself to death. I wasn't allowed to see my boys, and my heart was breaking. And I wanted to say to someone, because everybody in Jamaica had said to me, you deserve this. Why couldn't you stop drinking? Look where you've taken yourself. Look at you. Nobody had any compassion for me. I guess I don't blame them. But I wanted to say, what's wrong with me? Please help me. How can I live without my sons? Why can't I stop drinking? What's wrong with me? Can somebody please help me? But there was no one to say that to. And I got a little apartment in Miami. My ex-husband had given me the back child support. I got a few sticks of furniture. And I'd drink and pass out, and they'd come and steal my clothes, and they'd come and steal my furniture. And they'd come and take that which I had to give and that which I did not have to give. And in the end, I couldn't pay rent. I was selling my blood to buy alcohol. And I ended up living at the bottom of Lincoln Road on Miami Beach. And I had two green garbage bags. And in one of them was every piece of letter my sons had ever written to me. And in the other one was an old statue of Venus and a book, I think, by Jung called... I think it was Modern Man in Search of a Soul. I can't remember. I think that was what it was. And my life was a nightmare. And my feet were so swollen that the only thing I could get on them was a size 10 and a half flip-flop. And because of the heat, the rubber, and the dirt, when my family came and found me, those had to be dug out the soles of my feet. And that is where alcohol took me. Our co-founder Bill Wilson said, Alcoholics Anonymous is not a success story. Rather, it is the chronicle of our colossal human failure, turned to usefulness by the divine alchemy of a loving God. I was an utter and complete failure as a human being in every department of my life. I had lost everything of meaning and value. I no longer even looked like a woman. When my family eventually came and found me, they wept to see me. And they sobered me up, and I didn't want to go to Scotland, I wanted to go to Canada. And a funny thing happened, you know, one of these coincidences. My father was not a drinker, and he'd been in the army for many years in the Second World War, and then he had been in the Navy. And he retired. And one night he said to my mother, because nobody knew where I was, he said, I don't know where my lassie is. I don't know where my grandchildren are. He said, I'm going for a walk. And he went and dropped dead in the street the same time I was living on the street. Your American author, Scott Fitzgerald, who died of alcohol-related problems. He wrote that in the real dark night of the soul, it is always 3 o'clock in the morning. And this man, Carl Jung, said, until the soul gets what it needs, it will get sick again. And I was living in the 3 o'clock in the morning with a sick soul. And I went to Canada, and a poor man who'd known me for a long time felt so sorry for me, and he married me. And the first time I tried to kill him, he took me to a psychiatrist. And the second time they put me in the mental institution. And I am a retread in the mental institution. And you know, we've heard all the jokes about being in, I love being in the mental institutions because I'm safe from the greatest enemy I have. And when I first go in there for the first week or two, they'll give me drugs and oblivion 22 hours a day. And I try and get all kind of diagnoses so that they can give me more of those lovely googly-oogly pills. And the only entertainment we ever have is when one of us drops our cigarettes and our paper slippers and we're too zonked to do anything but watch it burn. Or else trying to light a cigarette, you know. And the last time I was in there, I was taken by the police and I was in a lot of trouble. And the psychiatrist came to me and said, I've had to write something to keep you out of prison. And he let me read it. And it had three diagnoses: chronic alcoholic, abnormal personality, and depressive. And those are all true. And I got out of there and the defense pleaded that I was a tragic social circumstance. I got off. And one night, you see, they had brought AA meetings into the institutions. But I never heard anything. And I heard later from some AA members that they used to say to me, Mary, do you have hope? And I would say to them, I have no hope. I have no hope. Anyway, one night I'm drinking myself sober. You know what that's like? In Edmonton, Alberta. And I picked up the phone and I phoned AA. And a man called Stan came. He was a Metis, which means he is a Native American French. Now here I have gone halfway around the world looking for some place to belong, for someone who spoke a similar language to me, for someone to maybe felt like me, who's somebody who maybe possibly, perhaps just a little, thought like I did. And here is this Aboriginal gentleman that I have more identification with than any place else or anywhere else in my life. And I am 40 years old. And Stan brought me the message. And he told me his story. And he said, he asked me to tell him, for me to tell a little bit of mine. And he said something that I always tell because it was so funny. I said, Stan, I know I'm an alcoholic, but I'm also nuts. I have a psychiatric report that says I'm nuts. He says, Mary, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is like 12 adjustable wrenches that fit any nut that comes through the door. He made me laugh. I got into AA. Wouldn't do what I was told. I had one slip. My dry date is the 10th of August, 1984. On the 9th of August, 1984, some AA members came and took me to a meeting. I was in very bad shape. I was shaking so much, strangers were waving back at me. That's what they told me. And that night, a little gal called Linda, who had 12 years sobriety, spent the night with me. And the next day she said, I'm going to leave you now because you're a loser. And my sponsor said I should only stick with winners and Alcoholics Anonymous. But before I go, I'm going to ask you to kneel down and say the third step prayer. I said to her, I kneel for nothing. And then something said, think of your children's eyes. And what came through my mind's eye was the Christmas before I had gone to Jamaica to try and see my boys one more time. And I had called my family in Scotland and said, please contact my ex-husband. Tell him I'm not drinking. I've just come out of the mental institution. I'm on medication. I'm not drinking. See if I can have my boys for 5 days, and I'll book a nice hotel in Jamaica. So my aunties, my family did that, and my boys were so excited. They called me and said, "Mommy, Mommy, you're coming down," and told me what they want for Christmas. And I got on the plane in Edmonton, and I got off in Toronto to change planes. I bought a bottle of vodka in Toronto, and by the time my plane reached Kingston, I was too drunk to walk. And my boys were at the airport, and I dropped down drunk in front of my boys. And the person who brought them to the airport led them away, trailing their Christmas presents, and me lying there in the airport. And they looked over their shoulder at me with the eyes of the child of an alcoholic. And that was what was in my mind's eye. And I knelt down and I held her hands and I repeated the third step prayer after her. "God, I offer myself to thee." I didn't know what I was doing. Something happened to me where I was willing to do what this girl who had 12 years sobriety, which seemed like a miracle to me. And she had given me time and spent the night with me when some people didn't want to talk to me. They said they had nothing in common with me from whence I had come. And I was obnoxious even then, because I didn't think anybody had been where I'd been or seen what I'd seen. I thought they were all toast burners. And something happened. And from that moment to this, I have had no desire for a drink. Some unmerited gift of grace was given to me. And this is what I believe today, in retrospect, because I didn't know what I was praying for. Or two. William James, who wrote The Varieties of Religious Experience, went around examining all these people who back then, I think it's early 19th century, late 19th century, they were dipsomaniacs, which is what people used to call alcoholics. And these dipsomaniacs had been skid row bums. And overnight, all of them had had some kind of a spiritual awakening. And they were running midnight missions, and they were caring for people, and they had become upstanding members of their community. And William James wanted to know what it was that had happened to them. What was this God they had found? And they had all had some kind of a conversion experience. And he said that the common denominator in each and every one is that they had all reached a place of absolute and complete despair. And I truly believe that I had reached that place of absolute and complete despair, which is the aperture that opens up whatever had been closed in me for God's grace. And I got very active in AA, and I did everything they told me. Get a sponsor, get active. 90 meetings in 90 days. If you don't like what we hear, we'll gladly refund you your misery. And I did a fourth and a fifth step very, very early because I hated myself. And I had to get all that stuff out. And I loved the meetings. And eventually I began to look. I remember maybe a few years ago, I called my old sponsor in Edmonton. I said, "Carol, a lot of my sponsees are being 12-step, or 13-stepped. I was never 13-stepped. She said, "Do you remember what you looked like when you came in?" She said, "We used to take you to a meeting in a shopping cart." I thought I was cute. The men were wonderful to me. They used to say, "Mary, hold your head up." Every time they see me looking down, they say, "Hold your head up. One day it's going to stay up by itself because you're going to take action. You're going to take action that will make you feel worthy. This program will give you a life of great meaning." And they said to me, "You might never get your children back. Your children might never come back to you. But you will have a family in AA." And I shook for 6 months. And they used to take me to a meeting, and the front was called Shaker's Row. And we all used to sit and shake. It was all the newcomers. And we all had goofy looks, and we would be trading horror stories. And learned a lesson. One day, we're all sitting there shaking and looking goofy and happy and pink clothed, and the window was open and something came in and it was up in the wall. And I see the guy next to me and he's looking up there and I start looking up there and the guy next to me says, and I don't know if it's really there. I don't trust their judgment, you know. And then there's an old timer, Ernie, and he patted me on the shoulder. He said, it's really there. It's a horsefly, for God's sake. Oh. Yeah. I knew that. So I had to trust your perception, not mine. And then, you know, the other great lesson was Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson was my higher power, because I didn't know what had happened to me when I said that third step prayer. I could not find a God in my own understanding, and I had made Bill Wilson my higher power, because when I read Bill Wilson, he just spoke straight to my soul. I loved Dr. Bob and what Dr. Bob had to say, but Bill was my man, and I made Bill my higher power, and everybody said, Bill Wilson is dead, and at that time I said, well, doesn't matter, he's there for me. And then they said, Mary, you really have this. It says in a big book, this book is about finding God. And you have to find God. And I said, okay. And I ran around looking for God. And the other thing, you know, the messenger comes in various shapes and sizes. And one day I was at a meeting and there was an old woman there. And she was the most spiritual woman I'd ever heard. But she was saying things like, as a drunken woman, I never went to bed with an ugly man, but I sure woke up with a few. She said, but I don't do it anymore because I am a lady in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went up to her afterwards. I said, who is this God you have? I'm looking for a God. She said, Mary, my God's called Harold. I said, Harold? I was expecting something more Greek. Or she says, yep, you know that prayer, Our Father who art in heaven, Harold be thy name. She was pulling my leg. But I found a God of my own understanding, which is the greatest thing I have today. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me so much. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a life beyond my wildest dream. But what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me is with my higher power, my God. My God that I believe is the God of Alcoholics Anonymous. What a marvelous God this is. We are the most fortunate people in the world. You know, every morning and every evening for 27 years, in the morning I get up and I kneel down. I say, Dear God, Heavenly Father, please keep me sober this day. Dear God, Heavenly Father, please keep me sane this day. Dear God, Heavenly Father, please walk with me this day and show me the way. I love thee, my God, and without thee I am truly nothing. And every night I kneel down because I will never take this thing for granted, because I know that I was beyond human aid. I know that nothing in the world could stop me from drinking. And I know that I suffered for when I took that one drink from the phenomena of craving that nobody can understand. And nobody in the world understands the illness of alcoholism, but we who have suffered from it. And only God, whatever God did in 1935 when he had that great chain of events, with Roland H. and then Ebby and then Bill and Bob, and a marvelous thing that we have been given that is not all the way around in the world. And I don't want it ever to change, do you? I want it to stay the way it is in case my children have to come. When I was about a year sober, I got a message that my son was going to school in Toronto and for a year. And we called into group. My sponsor and I and some AA people met my plane in Toronto and they checked me into the YWCA. And I started going to AA downtown, made contacts, got a sponsor called Rini. And Rini died at 53 years of sobriety, active every day. She died 3 years ago. Rini. Rini used to say to me, Mary, if God guides, God provides. And Rini used to tell me, Mary, keep your day in daytight compartments. And she used to talk about this great mosaic that is Alcoholics Anonymous. And Rini just loved me, and yet she was very tough on me. I remember the lessons that she taught me. It was about caring for another human being. In my early days, she said, meet me at 12 o'clock for lunch. And I got there at 12:05, and there was no Rini. And I hung around for 15 minutes and I called her. I said, Rini, I'm at the restaurant. She said, yeah, so was I, but I'm gone. I said, you mean to say you couldn't wait for me? She said, why should I? If you can't get on time, why should I wait for you? And she taught me about honoring time and honoring people. And then I got a job. And I got an apartment. And I was 2 years sober when my son went back. And you know, it's great that I'm in Georgia, because this is a little story about Georgia, and it ends up in Georgia. You know, the old timers used to say to me, no relationships for a year, but for you it's two. Because you have a propensity for getting married. And one day I'm at this meeting and I look down the table and I see him. And I just know that God has sent me my reward. And he's got these big blue eyes, and I'm batting my eyes at him. And you think the light in the eyes of the people is spirituality? Sometimes it's psychosis. But I'm talking about my eyes too, because like attracts like. And I truly believe until I get well, I will attract my insides on the outside. So John and I fell in love in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And here's what happens when you fall in love in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and you haven't had enough personality change to do anything about it and to have a good relationship. You know, in the 12 and 12 it says, when boy meets girl on AA campus. I love that. It's so poetic. Underneath it said, they should both examine themselves to see there is no deep psychological disorder stopping them from having a relationship. I don't like that part. So anyway, John and I fell in love in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happened was that we still go to a lot of meetings, and we'd have on our peacock feathers and we'd strut our stuff. And then someone would ask me to read How It Works, and my eyes would flit across a crowded room, and I would see him. And I could imagine John and I wandering off into the sunset under the circle and the triangle. And I could see Bill and Bob and Dr. Young up in the sky saying, bless you, my child. And it was a truly wonderful vision. It was beautiful. And I shared this with my sponsor, who has no romance in her soul. And Rini said, don't get married, you're an emotional retard. And I knew she was jealous. So John and I eloped. In the close intimacy of marriage, when you haven't had enough personality change to honor each other and have a good relationship, what happens in the close intimacy of marriage is that one by one the peacock feathers start dropping off. And in the end, all you have is the same two old turkeys staring at one another. And I had to leave that relationship because I was told to by my sponsor, and I went back to the Y and I surrendered to God one more time. Not because I didn't love John, I loved John. And he loved me. But I got into a relationship, I get psychotic. And so does he. We do not do it well. And eventually I got an apartment, and I went back to Jamaica. My sons were acting up. I was told to go back to Jamaica and make amends to the island. I stayed 2 years in Jamaica. I made amends to the island. And got my sons going elsewhere. One of them went, I sent them to Florida, to Broward Community College. One of them had been to the Florida Air Academy in Melbourne, Florida. And then eventually I sent that same one to Scotland. And then I went back to Jamaica, and I brought my boys, and we were living together. And John and I were still friends, and I was living in the same building. We loved each other. We were still married, but we couldn't live together. And we decided to get a legal separation, and I had the key for his apartment. And 10 days after I signed the legal separation with John, I was supposed to meet him to tie up some financial stuff, and I couldn't get him on the phone. And I had that intuitive thought that something's wrong with him, and I went and had the door kicked down because the door was bolted on the inside. And he was lying on the ground. He had a massive stroke. And they said that he'd been lying there for 3 nights and 2 days. And he was turning purple. And he was turning purple. And I said, God, if he lives, I'll look after him. And John was in hospital for 1.5 years. And then I took him home. And I had him home for 5 years. And he could never speak again, and he couldn't understand the spoken word. I'd still take him to AA. He'd get his medallions. And there was only 2 words John could say, and I can't say them from the podium. But essentially what they mean is take a journey. Anyway, one day, the amazing thing about John, although he had right arm paralysis, his left arm was good, and although they said his brain was gone, he could draw maps, and he used to go draw maps to Florida. And we were coming back through Georgia one day. We'd been in Florida for a vacation, and sometimes John needed to go to the little boy's room, and he had a way of telling me that. And I was speeding, and I was right coming through the highway on Georgia, and the police started chasing me, and and this very nice policeman stopped, and he said I was doing 120 in a 60, I can't remember what, 120 in a 60, which I didn't think was a big deal, but I tried to explain to him that my husband, John, had was, you know, had severe brain damage, and that he didn't speak. And the cop said, I said to the cop, the policeman said, you have to, you know, there's a fine here for speeding. I said, can I send you a check? He said, we don't take checks from Canada. So he said, there's an ATM conveniently located next to the police station. And so we went there, and he goes around to help John out with the car. And John says his famous 2 words. And the policeman said, I thought you said he couldn't talk. I said, that's all he knows, trust me. That's it. So that was my encounter with a Georgia policeman. And John died on the 20th of October 2001, and before he died, I read him How It Works, and then I held his body till he grew cold. And I finished something of worth for another human being. And then, you know, my parents were both dead by the time I got to AA. And the way I could make amends to them is by helping people who were old and more needier and didn't have anyone looking after them. That's how I did that. And I also wrote letters to my parents. And then my boys, it took me, even although we lived together and we had, and they loved me, but it was very difficult for a time. I sent them off to be self-supporting through their own contributions. And and you know, I was an open book to them. I said, ask me anything. And my eldest boy is a talker, and he talked and talked and talked and talked. And he was talking till he was 40, and he stopped talking about it, and he got it all out. The youngest one has never spoken much about it, but they're wonderful boys to me, and they love me very much. And you know, my eldest son got married on Vancouver Island, and his daddy flew out from Jamaica, and him and I walked my son down the aisle, which is a miracle of healing for me, believe me. And then my other son got married in full Scottish dress in a Ukrainian Orthodox church and danced with me to a tune called Mama. And I have 5 little grandchildren. And, you know, one of my sons now is in Aruba, and I go there every year. And the other one is in Vancouver Island, and I go there every year. And they come and see me, and I am blessed. You know, my eldest boy was the one that acted out the most because he saw the most about my alcoholism, and this thing goes very deep. This alcoholism goes very deep into our children. And my boy, he had all the isms, but he didn't drink, and he couldn't take authority, and he just was a great husband and a great father, but couldn't keep jobs long because of his temper. And recently, in the last three years, he's been doing fantastic. And the other day I said, son, you're doing so great. You don't have your eczema anymore, and you're doing really, really well. I'm so proud of you. I said, oh, I've been proud of you, but I'm so proud of you now. No more anger, no more rages. He said, well, Mom, I've implemented the 12 steps in my life. He said, I saw what it did for you, and I want some of that too. And I am truly blessed. And I have found it myself. You know, I loved the session on 6 and 7 today because it's my defects of character. And the way my defects of character come up is in the strangest way. You know, I can have a wonderful spiritual week. I've spoken to my crazy sponsees, whom I love, but they drive. I've got one that's got a little scrawny neck, and she's been there forever, but she's always into kung chu, hung chu, any kind of chu-chu, and any kind of whatever is recent and chi-chi, or these games that they do, and taekwondo, and she just won't get into the steps, and she drives me insane. And then she's eating, she's gotten this new eating habit away, and she's sitting there, and she's just a talking mouth and a neck. That's all she is. And sometimes I can see myself putting my fingers around her little scrawny neck and saying, shut up! And giving her an injection, a spiritual injection, you know? But I don't, I just say, keep coming back, baby. But you know, anyway, and they drive me to destruction. And then life, you know, life sometimes, life is good, but you know, there's a lot of problems. There's financial problems, there's this kind of problem, there's every kind of problems. And you know, I'm a happy camper, I get very active in AA, but here's how my alcoholism works today. I can have a wonderful 5 days when I'm spiritually fit. Then I wake up one morning and there's something not right. And I don't know what it is, but it's not right. So then what happens is, I will go to a meeting. Now I have my chair, because I was there from that meeting started, 1985. That's my chair. And then I might go there, and one of our regular attendees is sitting in my chair. And I know now there is a plot to oust me from that role. And then I'll say hello to someone who's a newcomer, or I haven't seen him in a group before, and he'll just look right through me. And I know that he has a resentment. And I'll go home and think about these two things. And then I'll make a plan to get there an hour early next week so I can get my chair. And then I'll go and find out which group this guy goes to regularly, so I'll go and say hello again and see if he answers me. And then I get out of it. And that's my defects of character. Also, my defects of character are impatience sometimes. And today I know what to do with these thoughts when they come in. I pray them away. And I also talk to my sponsor. My sponsor is more important to me than she has ever been before. The reason is I have more to lose. The reason is I am more conscious. I am so much more conscious when I do something wrong today, or if when I don't think and let this. You know, but Dr. Bob says, guard that erring member, the tongue. Sometimes I don't think about that, and I will give a retort that I'm immediately sorry for, and I have to make amends. And I do that. But then I think, and I'm hard on myself, I say, why did you do that? You see, I have to be hard on myself and gender. I have found, I truly believe that the essence of spirituality today, this is just my belief, is kindness. Kindness to each other. In the beginning, I used to be quite a tough sponsor because I had had some tough sponsors, because I needed that. But now I see that it is kindness. And I can see that not everybody is the same when they come in here. And the same love and tolerance that many people gave me, I have to give. And I might be the only big book that anybody ever, ever reads. So I better carry myself in constant vigilance that I am there as a 27-year member of Alcoholics Anonymous and behave accordingly. And, you know, I say to people, I love my God, but I'm afraid of God. They say, you shouldn't be afraid of God. I said, oh, yeah? What I have found is a God who is all power, justice, and love. I truly believe that the spiritual life is as sharp as the edge of a razor. And the more sober we get, the more spiritual we get. And the more spiritual we try to behave. And if I screw up today on that spiritual path, God will be back at me like that. I will feel the repercussions immediately, because that is how my God operates for me. So any friend of God is a friend of mine. You know, I love my God. So I am so delighted to be here. I have had the most wonderful time. My journey has been a journey that has led me to places that I hope those who haven't gone never have to go. My journey through Skid Row was like going through a sewer in a glass-bottom boat. I never believed I would see the sunlight again. I never believed I would be with people like you. I never believed that I would be able to lift my head up, to see my children. To see my children look at me and say, Mom, I'm so proud of you. To see my children say, Mom, I love you. I love you. And to see my little grandchildren look at me and tell me they love me more than fresh vegetables. And to partake in that innocence and know that I can be trusted. So, look at all these wonderful people that made this possible for us. Look at you who made this possible. Look at for these wonderful speakers. All of my favorite speakers are here. I love them so much. I'm so grateful for the messages they continue to give me and inspire me with. And I thank you so much for having me here. Thank you.